FM Rewind, Vow 88.1. Science Wise on Vow 88.1.
Today we're going to be joined by a young scientist who's making science more relatable for the next generation. From researching ecological corridors at the UP Tucks to teaching high school learners in Mamelodi about climate change from an African perspective, she's not just studying the planet. She's shaping how we understand and protect it. This is a conversation that you really don't want to miss out. If you want to be part of the conversation, hit us up on our WhatsApp line 0074-577-9461, or you can hit us up on our social media platforms so that you can be part of the conversation. So on tonight on Science Wise, we are diving into the world of environmental science, geology, and climate education. We are taking a step back to look at one of the biggest questions in science. What makes our planet habitable, and how do we keep it that way? In an age where scientists have discovered thousands of other planets, understanding what makes Earth special has become more important than ever. But this isn't just a question for researchers. It is something that affects all of us, so we all play a role in this. Around the world and right here in Southern Africa, educators and young scientists are finding new ways to share this knowledge, helping people see how the land, water, air, and living things are connected. Through outreach and research, they are turning complex science into everyday understanding, from climate change and biodiversity to how communities can adapt and protect the environments they depend on. Today, we meet some of these passionate postgraduates who are bringing the gap between science and society, showing the learning about our planet isn't just for classroom, it is for everyone. Today, we are joined by Ayanda Mogalekwena, an MSc zoology student at the University of Pretoria, whose research focuses on ecological corridors, those vital green pathways that allow animals and plants to move and thrive in changing landscape. Beyond her research, Ayanda is passionate about making science accessible through the Access High School program, in program in Mamelodi, where she and her fellow graduates teach learners about climate change from an African perspective. From her background in aquaculture and wastewater management to her work in terrestrial ecology, Ayanda's journey highlights how science can protect ecosystems, inspire young minds, and change young minds and empower communities to take part in building a sustainable future. Without wasting any further time, please help me welcome Ayanda Mogalekwena. Hello, Ayanda.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
All good, man. I just want to say, man, you're making such a huge impact in our society right now. I just want to give you your props without wasting any further time. Nothing but respect for you, my sister.
Thank you.
So without wasting any further time, I just want to jump straight to the questions. So your work with, is it Access or Access program?
Access.
Okay. Your work with Access program introduces high school students to climate change in relatable ways. What inspired you to start engaging with learners, and what does a typical classroom session look like?
My involvement with Access Habitable Planet Workshop grew from a deep passion for making science, especially climate change, since I love climate change, more relatable and relevant to young people. So I realized that many learners from my community, or rather from the local community and the disadvantaged background, they hear about climate change as something distant or purely scientific, but not as something that affects their daily lives and future opportunities. That is why I want to teach them that climate change is real and it's something that we are faced with. Through Access, I'm able to bridge that gap. I'm able to take my scientific knowledge and bring it to the classroom, bring it to the local areas to ensure that they understand the impact of climate change. And a typical day in the Access program, we have peer educators, which are students like us, that come to these learners so they feel represented. They feel like this is something that they can also do. And then these peer educators would then tackle a certain topic of the day and then would have an activity that relates to that particular topic and end off with group discussions to try and get the learners to think critically about what we've taught them, the activities that we have done, and how they can contribute to the solution, or rather the topic that we discussed.
So why do you think it's important to bring an Africanized perspective into climate change education?
For me, it's You know, when you're in high school and they say climate change, the only thing you're thinking about, you're thinking about geography, you're thinking about social science, you're never thinking about it as something that is real. So I think it's important to bring an Africanized perspective into climate change education because our experiences, our challenges, and our solutions are unique. Too often, climate narrative come from the global voices, you know, the global north, the people who don't even live here. They discuss the climate issues that we face, and these narratives don't always reflect the reality of African communities, like, for example, how rural people would depend on natural resources, or how urban areas face equal access to water and energy. So I believe that if we bring that Africanized approach, we are able to recognize the problems that we are facing as African people, and then embark on what we call indigenous knowledge, you know, knowledge that has already been there, build on that to try and find solution with the problems that we ourselves are facing, and we understand the intensity of those problems, not the global voices that speak about these issues like it's just, you know, like they don't understand the intensity of them. So I believe that that's where African perspective plays a huge role in trying to find unique solutions for unique problems.
So, what do learners find most relatable when you explain climate change in their everyday context? For example, through local weather, farming, or water issues?
One of the key things when you're teaching climate change, like I said, that for the longest time it's seen as this a word in the textbook, this big word in the
Yes.
textbook. What we try to do is try to find a concept that would impact the climate. For example, the changes in the rainfall or water shortages, things that could come from the climate change, and how the learners would then engage in them. They would share stories on how water shortages would affect their families, how changes in the rainfall patterns would affect their crops or gardens, and some of them even shared stories that the grandparents shared with them that the weather used to be different and it used to be favorable. Now they get to think, okay, if the weather was that way and was favorable to the grandparents, what happened and what is it that we can do to ensure that we don't suffer the consequences of these changes in the climate? So they relate strongly when we discuss these local solutions, like your water saving techniques, your recycling, doing community cleanups, and it also gives them hope to understand that they play a role in this big picture that we have.
So I understand. So there's this, this idea, this notion that science people believe sometimes science is not for them, or it's too complicated, or science is just for smart people. How do you help change that perception and make science feel accessible? Especially amongst young people, because sometimes, some people believe like science is not for them and all of that. How can we change that narrative?
So I think we can change the narrative by making science not to be about lab coats. Science, it's not lab coats. Science, it's not bombastic big words, but it's about understanding how the world around us works. So how we do this, or how me and my team mostly try to do this, is whatever concept that we teach, it does not matter how many bombastic words that are there or how intensive it is. We try to use everyday examples. For example, I was teaching the distance from the sun, how we get energy from the sun and all of that. And the example that we used is to understand a fire, to say that when you are standing closer to a fire, it's more hot. You get warmer quicker. But the minute you move away from the fire, you don't get as warm as you used to when you were closer to the fire. But that does not mean that the fire has lost its fire or its spark, or the intensity of the fire has reduced. But it's because of the distance. Now it has to cover a longer distance to reach you. And that is exactly what happens with the sun and other planets, why other planets are hotter than planet Earth. So when you use such everyday examples, they get to understand science better. They get to understand that it's really not about the big words, but it's about the world around you, how it works, and how you can ensure that you don't lose that key in making the earth habitable.
Just building on that, right? Can you share a story or a moment when a learner surprised you with their curiosity or understanding of science?
I could share so many stories.
We have all the time in the world, actually.
I could share so many stories. I remember this one time, but it was not even during a classroom session. We're having just a normal conversation during lunch, and we're talking about rainfall and how we have rainfall in winter, and we used to not have that. It's only people in Cape Town that have rainfall in winter. And Elena would be like, oh yeah, and my mom also shared that story that we didn't have rainfall and now we have rainfall in winter, and how when we speak about groundwater, the whole reservoir of how rainfall comes about. Then I was like, and it's so strange that my mom, who is from Pretoria, when she goes back to Limpopo, she's always talking about how the borehole water tastes different than how it used to be. And to her, it's like, how would I even know that the borehole water would taste different if I didn't know, if I was in there when my mom was growing up in Limpopo? So that kind of showed me that these learners, they pay attention. They're able to ask questions that reveal deeper knowledge. They're able to know things about those small details that we think are not important. That makes science are the exact same small details that these learners are interested about. They're interested in understanding. They're interested in asking more questions on, okay, why is it that the water doesn't taste the same? Why is it that we have rain in winter? Does that mean that when I go to Cape Town in December, is it going to rain? What are those changes? So that kind of interaction made me feel like what we are doing is actually working. These learners are able to ask relevant questions. They're able to step out of their comfort zone and understand that the world around them is just a big laboratory that is waiting for them to explore.
So can you please also, if you won't mind, what are some of the challenges that did you encounter during, you know, or through teaching? What are some of the challenges that you have encountered, especially when you were teaching these young next generation of young scientists?
One of the biggest challenge is confidence. Because the learners that we deal with are learners from local communities. These are learners from disadvantaged backgrounds. So when they are being taught in the classroom, they are being taught what's in the textbook only, right? So they don't have confidence in them voicing their feelings, voicing what they understand about the world around them. As a matter of fact, the only thing that is important to them is just understanding what's in the textbook and writing it to pass. But now the problem with that is that you have people who can't think critically. They don't have that skill to critically think. They don't have that confidence to speak out when they see that this is happening like this and it's supposed to be happening like this. They're not going to say it out loud because of the environment and the type of structure that they are being taught in. So one of the biggest challenge was trying to get them out of their comfort zone, trying to make them confident. And when they are then confident, they then start pointing out things. I remember this one time we had Elena call us, like it was late at night, telling us that the moon is red, you know, come and check out, the moon has changed the color, and we get to discuss that. But when they are still in that particular, in the local area, just focusing on what's on the textbook, not on what's around them, the world around them, they never get to learn further than what the textbook teaches them. So they never get to see things, they never get to be curious, they never get to be to critically think and be able to engage with other learners. So I think that has been the biggest thing. And also I think the limitation in the resources, you know, most of them that we're dealing with, they've never even touched a computer, and it's a problem. You know, they don't know how to do PowerPoint, they don't know how to type in a computer, and we have to bridge that gap. We have to ensure that as much as we're tutoring them maths and social sciences, we have to also teach them other skills that are not related to the program, but that are going to help them in engaging with other learners out there who are getting access to these other resources.
Can you also please share some of your highlights or some of the achievements that you've witnessed through this journey?
The biggest achievement is seeing learners being able to explain the things that you're teaching in class, you know, in simpler terms, in their own weights. But one of the other things that we do is we take them to other places where they can engage with people who are not us, who, on different concepts, to try and see how they're able to think about certain things. So one of the things that we did was give them an activity where they had to then look at Mamelodi and look at what makes Mamelodi special. And we gave them a criteria of they need to look at the geology of Mamelodi, the climate of Mamelodi, the culture, and all of that. And the responses that they came with, that was, you know, that was mind-blowing, because they would come up with solutions that you did not even think about. These learners were not only thinking about what we had limited to say, we need plants, we need animals, we need water for the planet to survive. They even brought the technology aspect of it to say, you know what, we understand all these other concepts, but because of the limitation in technology, this and this can happen. So that was one of the moments that we realized that this program is really making an impact in the learner's life, not only in their lives, in their family's life, because you engage also with their parents. The parents would also share stories with how the learners have changed, and also seeing the behavior. You see, you find one learner who wasn't speaking for the past 4 or 5 months, and suddenly this learner is able to engage in a conversation, is able to stop you while you're teaching and say, ma'am, this is like this, this is like that. Didn't you say this is like this, like that? So that is an achievement on our side, to see them getting outside of their comfort zone, to see them being able to notice the area that they're from, you know, to not say that, okay, we just want to be successful and get out of Mamelodi, but recognizing what makes Mamelodi special, what makes Mamelodi significant on planet Earth, and which, what are the heritage, or rather the cultural things about Mamelodi that help understand the science in Mamelodi, and how can we as the young coming scientists make sure that that culture is not lost.
Okay, so Africa has the world's youngest population, right? How do you see this youth demographic as a strength in leading environmental action?
I believe that the South African youth, or the African youth, are the greatest strength of Africa. Because if you look at us, we represent energy, we represent creativity, and we represent the will to change. And where there's a will, there's a way. So young people in South Africa, I think I'll speak about South Africa since I'm from South Africa, we're not held back by how things have always been. We're always looking into we also always eager to question things, you know. We want to understand. It's not about how this used to be, but it's understanding why it's like that, and is it working for us in this generation? And that then forces us to be innovative and also act towards certain things. And when it comes to environmental action, if you check in the spaces, most people who are leading environmental actions are young Africans. They are leading cleanups. They are leading sustainability clubs. They are using social media to raise awareness and even developing green technologies. I believe that this generation is deeply connected both to the digital world, but also to their local community, which makes them powerful agents of change. And I believe that with the right support and the right opportunities, the young African people can drive a just transition that is rooted in our own values and our own realities.
So your MSc research focuses on ecological corridors. Could you explain in simple terms what they are and why they're important, especially here in South Africa?
Ecological corridors are natural pathways that connect different habitats. These can be in a form of bridges that allow animals or plants or even genetic material to move between areas. And why they're important is that Africa as a whole is characterized by a rich diversity of wildlife. This includes a wide range of unique animals and plant species that significantly contribute to the continent's overall biodiversity. However, the majority of these species are found within landscapes that are closed down, and these landscapes are managed by human beings, primarily through the establishment of the national parks, the nature reserves, your zoos, which all are thought to create to provide a safe haven for these wildlife. But now the problem, or where the term ecological corridor fits in, is that when we keep fencing all these particular areas down, we are limiting the gene flow in these areas because there is no pathway that is allowed between these nature reserves. So when we limit the gene flow, we expect that the genetic diversity would decrease. And if, for example, something happens, the climate changes, temperature increases, and one particular habitat, the animals there or the plants there get hit with this increase in temperature and they don't survive. When the genetic diversity is low, we don't have other species that we can then maybe say that they can then withhold the structure or the functionality of that ecosystem. That is why we need corridors for that movement of genes between different habitats.
Okay. So how do ecological corridors fit into the broader goals of climate change adaptation and biodiversity conservation?
Ecological corridors play a key role in both climate change adaptation and biodiversity conservation because they help species survive in a world that is constantly changing. So as temperatures rises, rainfall pattern shifts, and many other climate changes, many species need to move to new areas where conditions are suitable. So corridors make that movement possible by connecting fragmented habitat and allowing wildlife to migrate and find resources. But the key thing is this, is that plants can move. You know, you can't have a grass choosing that I can move from this area to that area. So the grass would then depend on other on animals, for example, your livestock, your buffaloes, your zebras, to facilitate that gene flow for them. So corridors provide them with that opportunities. Corridors also support ecosystem services like your pollination, water regulation, soil stability to ensure that there isn't overgrazing in one place. Animals have access to ample land to graze, and that they also support rangeland, or essentially areas that communities and people depend on for their crops. Mm-hmm. In a bigger picture, I would say that corridors are just about resilience, building that resilience for your plants, for animals, and also for us as human beings. Corridors ensure that nature can respond to climate pressures, not just today, but also in the future. And in South Africa, where we have incredible biodiversity and have landscapes that are managed by human beings, maintaining these connections between these areas is the most practical way to safeguard both the people and our planet.
Okay, so beyond research, how can the idea of ecological corridors influence things like urban planning, agriculture, or the design of protected areas in South Africa?
Ecological corridors is not just a concept for conservation scientists. They have real applications in how we design and manage our landscape. The main idea of ecological corridors actually came from different landscape management, how people manage different landscape and how these management strategies would then impact the functionality of ecosystem. For example, in urban planning, corridors can guide the creation of green spaces, your river buffers, as well as tree-lined streets that connect parks and nature reserves. This ensures that in a city, we also have biodiversity, but we also have good air quality because corridors will improve the air quality, reduce heat, and give people access to nature in these cities. But also, the key thing about corridors is that when you speak about fragmented land, like I said, that it's mostly fenced down areas. It's your nature reserve, it's your national parks, it's your zoos. They are areas within these protected or fragmented areas, which we call as rangeland. And these are where people are found. Corridors connect devote the national parks as to people, to other national parks. So we can then use the rangeland or areas where people are found as a connection between fragmented areas that are essentially just fenced down for to be a safe haven for animals. This then makes conservation efforts more effective at a landscape scale rather than focusing on these isolated patches. In short, the idea of ecological corridors encourages us to think beyond the boundaries that are already there to design human spaces that work with nature, not against nature.
Interesting. So, are there any gaps in environmental policy or management that your research could help address?
Yes. One of the main gaps is that environmental policies, specifically in South Africa, often focus on protecting isolated reserves without always considering how these areas can be connected. So, as conservation efforts increasingly focus on these protected areas to safeguard the biodiversity, to safeguard the vulnerable species that are there, the surrounding areas, which include rangelands, have often been ignored regarding their potential to contribute to the ecological connectivity. However, these rangelands are very important not only to ecologists but also to people who stay there, because traditionally these rangelands were used and are still being used for livestock grazing. And them being used for livestock grazing makes them fundamental to the landscape that connects these protected areas. So that's the gap that's found, that we're not really focusing on connecting or using these rangeland in connecting or facilitating gene flow between the protected areas. Another research gap that is there, which is a huge problem, is that we all know about traffic cascade. When you start doing grade 9, you start learning about traffic cascade and how we need a predator, apex predator, to eat the herbivores so that the herbivores do not overgraze. But we don't know to the intensity that apex predator would have on the grass species, would have on the plant. Do we then say, because one thing that we realize is that grass species are able to switch from vegetative reproduction to sexual reproduction. But when they choose to switch from that, we don't know that there isn't much information on that. So this research filled that gap as well, to say that now we get to understand from the plant's point of view that when they are being grazed too much, to what extent would they then decide to switch to vegetatively, or to what extent would they then choose to just continue with sexual reproduction, or to what extent that the plants would actually die off and not be able to pass on genetic material to the next generation of plants.
I'm sure like balancing postgraduate research with outreach and volunteer work can be tough. So how do you manage such demands? How do you manage those demands?
Sure, yeah. It takes grace. It really takes grace. I think, yeah, the first one is prayer. It really takes God to give you that balance. But one thing that I also do is that I treat my outside of academia life, which is your outreach or the volunteer work and my research, as complementary work instead of work that competes for my time. Right? So this then makes me to be able to strategize on how much time I can give to my schoolwork, or how much time I can give to my personal life, how much time I can give to my family, how much time I can give to my volunteer work. And it also helps me to set clear goals. When we speak about clear goals, people come and say clear goals with thinking someone has a diary that they write on everything and they have to follow it to the T. That does not work for me. What I do, I become realistic. I know myself. I know how my struggles with time and where I'm kind of strong when it comes to managing time. So I set goals that are realistic to me, realistic to my schedule, realistic to my life. And I'm sure that these goals are not goals that are going to burn me out. I don't set goals that I'm setting for, I don't know, Barack Obama or whoever, but I set goals for Ayanna, goals that are realistic for me. And also, I think it's really about passion and purpose. Someone once said to me, if you want something as much as you want to breed, you will find a way. So I'm very passionate about the work that I do. So I try by all means. I make sure that I find time to do the things that I love to do.
Building on that, what gives you the drive, man? Like, how? What gives you the drive? What gives you the motivation, you know, to like hit everything and, you know, achieve every goal that you've set for yourself in each and every thing that you're involved in? What gives you the drive? What gives you the energy?
Firstly, it's a supportive family. I have a very, I have a community that is very supportive. You know, I have people around me that always support me in all that I do. But secondly, is being clear about your goals. So you need to know what you want to do as a person, and you need to be transparent about it, especially to your community. So when you set a pool of people that are going to be your community, it needs to be people that you are comfortable sharing things with them, so that they can be able to hold you accountable. You know, when you are not studying, they hold you accountable that, hey, you wanted to do this and you're not going to do it if you think like this. So that really helps, having a supportive family, having supportive friends, having a supportive community around me that knows my goals, that knows where I want to be. But also, one thing that you need to also make a personal decision. I always say, when you're intentional about something, you always find a way to do it. So don't treat, for example, don't treat your schoolwork as just something that you need to do. You need to make sure that you're passionate about it. If you're doing a postgrad, do a project that you really, really, really love, so that when it gets hard, because trust me, it gets really, really hard. So you would need that passion would be the one that really pushes you. But if you don't love what you're doing, if you don't have that passion for what you're doing, you can have a great community, but essentially what they're saying falls on deaf ears because you're not really passionate about this. So ensure that whatever that, you know, the Bible says that whatever that your hands finds to do, do it unto the Lord. Ensure that whatever your hands finds to do is what you enjoy doing, so that you don't do things for the sake of just doing it, but you do it unto the Lord.
Amen. So as a young woman in science, what challenges have you faced, and what advice would you give to other women considering STEM careers?
Being a woman in science comes with its own challenges. Man, I was just having a conversation with my supervisor a week ago about the challenges that we face. She's a female as well. You deal with stereotypes, you know, you become underestimated. Every single time I feel like I have to like twice as hard to be taken seriously. You know, I was out there in the field, and when you're out there in the field, you find people asking you, are you able to walk 10 kilometers? They're not asking because they can. They're asking because you are female, you know? So it's those things that you have to be. There's a lady that I once worked with, and she once told me that you need to be able in life, sit down with yourself and be conscious, know yourself, and pinpoint things that hurt you and pinpoint things that you would not let to hurt you. For example, the stereotypes. If you know that stereotypes are things that would discourage you, deal with them before you get out there. You know, so that when you get out there, you already know that I've dealt with this. It does not matter what anyone thinks, what anyone says. I know that this is what I want, and I'm going to do it. So my advice to other women who are considering STEM is to stay curious, stay focused to the goal. Find mentors, man. I am a huge fan of community. Find or build a supportive community. Do not be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask risks. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm a risk taker. I take the most bizarre risks. Don't be afraid to take risks and pursue things that excite you. You know, one of the things, the things that helps me dealing with all these challenges, it's because I do something that I'm very passionate about. I really love what I am doing. So to any ladies out there considering to do STEM, just know that your perspective is valuable, and diversity in science leads to better ideas. And you being a female, you are bringing that aspect of diversity. So be more creative in your solutions. Don't be comfortable, you know. Comfortability is not, we say it's nice, but don't be comfortable in people just saying, this is what's bring on the table, let's go with it. Always try to grow yourself and think outside of the box. So
finally, right, where do you see your journey in environmental science taking you, both in your research and in mentoring the next gen? Sorry, in mentoring the next generation.
I see my journey in environmental science as a combination of research. I really, really love research, but I love implementation. I love, action and mentorship. So on the research side, I want to continue exploring solutions that make our landscapes more resilient, whether through this project, ecological corridors, or sustainable land management, or even other climate adaptation strategies. I'm really working forward, and I hope that my work can inform policies, because I'm really interested in understanding environmental policies and how we can engage with them so that they're not just words on paper, but we can then go out and implement practices that protect biodiversity and communities. And equally as important, in terms of mentoring the next generation, I really want to keep engaging with the learners through the Access program and even other programs that might come in the future, to show them that science is accessible, science is relevant, and science is empowering. I believe that by sharing this knowledge and also absorbing Indigenous knowledge, experiences, and other opportunities, I'm going to inspire others to take ownership of environmental challenges and become leaders in their own communities. Ultimately, my goal is to bridge the gap between science and society. I don't believe that these two should have been separated in the first place. I believe that they are one. They should work together. We should use Indigenous knowledge, but we should also use science to try and find solutions.
Okay. So if people want to connect with you regarding work related information, or if they want, some sort of, they want to assist, however, where can they get in contact with you?
I'm currently not on social media.
Okay.
But I can leave my email so that people can connect with me. My email address, which is ayandamgalikwena@gmail.com. But yeah, that's where people can engage mostly with me. And when it comes to social media, I'm not really that much active.
Ayanda, thank you so much for the time. Thank you so much for actually taking this call and making the time to actually come and educate us about everything that you do. And thank you so much for the time that you made for us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. All the best with everything.
Thank you.
Bye. That was Ayanda Mogalekwena.
Science Wise on Vow 88.1. FM Rewind. Vow 88.1.